Why Can't We Live Together? Timmy Thomas is what you just heard coming into this piece. He was born on this day. We are going to wrestle with the issue of homelessness once again here on the Mark Steiner Show, especially in response to the story by our partner organization, City Paper. There was an article written called Gimme Shelter, Why is Homeless Policy So Disconnected from the Daily Struggle of the People Trying to Find a Place to Stay? And Eric Erickson wrote that piece. He joins us by phone, staff writer for the Baltimore City Paper. We're also joined by Adam Schneider, Director of Community Relations for Healthcare for the Homeless, Tony Simmons, housing advocate and member of Housing Our Neighbors. Kate Bedell is with us. She's director of the Homeless Services Program at the Mayor's Office of Human Services. And Adrian Bridenstine is with us. And Adrian is the new executive director of the Journey Home at the Mayor's Office of Human Services. And welcome all of you. Good to have you in the studio.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you for having us.
And Eric as well. I mean, Ed as well. I called you Eric. I meant to call you Ed. Excuse me. 410. Didn't mean to change your name. 410-319-8888 is the number here. You can write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook page or tweet us at Mark Steiner. 410-319-8888 to join in on this conversation. So very quickly, Ed, let me just turn to you first. Give us a sense of this very lengthy piece you wrote. And you wrote it, then you gave it this title. So talk about the kind of the boil down the essence of what you found.
Well, you know, I just walked outside and stood in line with folks outside the Weinberg Center on the Falls Way. I mean, it's really not, there's not much to it, really. You could see that there are people who are pretty much always waiting. It's a shelter for, they call it a low barrier shelter. And as a person, you know, in the center of the city, when people walk up to me, I would always say, well, you know, you can go over there. They're going to help you. And they do. Don't get me wrong. But it's a really complicated process because there's too many people to fit in that place. It takes 275. So now you have to have an overflow shelter, and that's now out at Sinclair Lane. But that's only been there a little while, and it's going to move, I think, later this year, early next year at some point, probably, maybe. So, and then that sort of fills up, too. And, of course, you can't get to the overflow without waiting in line at the, you know, at the Falls Way. So it seems like it's a lot to sort of know, and apparently it changes quite often. And it's fairly confusing, and it was confusing to me just to walk in and start trying to figure it out. So you look at that, and then you say, well, you know, why? And, of course, everybody says why. And it turns out, as all the folks on your panel know, it turns out the United States used to house people. We used to pay directly and spend the money and put people in housing for the most part. And other civilized countries do the same thing. But we stopped doing that in the 80s and into the 90s. And so now we have a bureaucracy and infrastructure that's designed to deal with the emergency that we created by cutting HUD funding way back in like 1980, 81.
So let me jump into this one with our other guests here. And because I think let me just touch with a historical point that Ed just raised. I think it's really important to talk about that. When people look at the city, people look at cities across the country, and they see homeless people all over the place, all the time, every day. If you're in any major city downtowns, you can't not walk past somebody who's homeless. It is a relatively recent phenomenon. It's a phenomenon of the last 30-odd years in this country since Ronald Reagan cut the budget by, what was it, how many billion dollars?
It was many billions, and in today's money, and it was like almost two thirds.
Yeah, it's about 40% of what it 40% of what it was back in 1979, and the cuts actually started. The cuts actually started under the Carter administration, but then we saw dramatic increases in cuts to housing and social services and other things under the Reagan administration, for sure.
And as the thing kind of snowballed since the early 80s into now this 21st century, we've still not been able to get a handle on homelessness. It's just in some ways gotten worse with housing prices, cost of medical care, increased unemployment, people losing jobs in major industry. I mean, homelessness has ballooned. I think that's the issue here. And talk about why we think. Let's talk about this side of the table. Not that really there's two sides here, because everybody around this table wants to end homelessness. There's no question. But why is it that do we think it's been so difficult to put our hands around this problem that's been growing for all these years?
Well, I'll just chime in here. One thing I will say is I think the Gimme Shelter article did a really nice job with providing that historical context for explaining why we see this mass homelessness that we see today. And because that's important. And, there, as Adam said, there was a significant slash to HUD's budget, which was one of the causes that led to the homelessness we see today. But the other issue is our response to homelessness. The McKinney-Vento Act was passed in 1987, and that law was initially passed to be a quick fix for the problem, and it didn't get at really what the systemic causes were for the problem, which was lack of housing, lack of an adequate safety net. Incomes weren't keeping up with the cost of housing. So this bill was passed in 1987, and it was already inadequate to solve the problem.
And McKinney-Vento.
Ed, I really want to let the panel jump in here. Go ahead.
I think I read the McKinney-Vento Act for this, and as I recall it, it was mostly about making sure kids of homeless people could get to school. There was a big sort of, correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought that was more aimed at oh, well, you know, we can at least get you in school, wasn't it?
That's partially correct. That's part of what McKinney-Vento does. McKinney-Vento actually has a multitude of components to it, some of it housing, some of it education. And part of the frustration with McKinney-Vento is that it defines homelessness differently for each one of the components. So homeless children are defined differently under the education component than they are under the HUD component. One other aspect, as Adrian said, about the McKinney-Vento and how it was kind of thrown together to really try to be a crisis response is that so the system, quote unquote, in Baltimore City for homelessness or addressing homelessness was really not put together on a systemic way initially. Programs cropped up to try to meet the needs of the clients that they were seeing. And so that's how we ended up with this, program-centric model. And what we're moving towards in Baltimore City is actually a systemic model.
Well, let me ask that question. So I want to remember what you just said.
Sure.
Moving from program model to systemic model, because that's a critical issue here. But, there was an article in the New York Times today that was by Frank Bruni, a commentary piece, where he kind of looked at cities across the country, including Baltimore, and that rather than rebuild, cities want to tear down. So rather than rebuild housing, you want to tear down. Like, we have laws in the city that say that if you build a new development, then 10% of those houses should be for lower-income people. That has never happened in the history of any development in the city of Baltimore. No one's doing that. The city does not enforce that law or force developers to build that housing. So I wonder, let me get your comments here from the other side of the table as well about, I want to see the other side because I have me sitting on different sides, not that they're adversaries. But Adam, let me start with you and then go over to Tony. I mean, just your analysis of why we are where we are.
Yeah, I mean, the problem of homelessness is fundamentally a symptom, right? It's a symptom of a much broader problem, the problem of the lack of affordable housing and housing in particular for people who are low income, right? It's not that we have an inadequate supply of housing. We have, in this country, in this city, more housing than we have people. We have many more.
Let me interrupt one. As I do this, it's not being impolite.
No.
I just want to get to what you're saying when
sure.
you say that. Because I hear that a lot from advocates. We have more housing than in Baltimore that we could house other people. Give me a little sense of what that means, because I see housing in Baltimore. I see boarded up houses. I see housing in Baltimore. I see homes that are either cost huge amounts of money in certain neighborhoods, or I see places in that are inexpensive because of some really poor neighborhoods. Where are these houses you're talking about?
Well, they're all over. But the point is, the issue is distribution, right? This is a distribution problem. It's not a problem of a lack of resources. I mean, another way of looking at this, I mean, Maryland is the wealthiest state in the wealthiest country in the history of the world. The wealthiest state in the wealthiest country in the history of the world. It's not that we don't have the resources to address these problems. It's that we don't have the political will. We don't have a system that is adequately responding. Things are distributed in a way that is fundamentally unjust and that causes these these symptoms, right? Homelessness is a symptom. Homelessness is a symptom of a city where 1 in 4 people live in poverty, that has a official unemployment rate of 10%, where there are 100,000 eviction notices every year. I mean, this is these are the fundamental problems. If we're going to end homelessness, we can't simply focus on homelessness. We have to focus on these broader problems. And that's really, I think, where the weakness of McKinney-Vento is, right? I mean, McKinney-Vento, as Kate said, was intended to be an emergency response to an emergency issue. We have now created a much broader problem by not addressing the fundamental causes. And that's where we need to direct our attention.
Tony, your thoughts? We're going to go to Kate.
Well, I'm one of the 135, 140 guys who was in the line when the reporter was there. And many of the guys there do have jobs, but they have low wage paying jobs. And with the rising cost of housing, their paychecks never going to meet the rise. And only thing we see is when we travel the streets of Baltimore, and I've been here most all of my life, is the dwindling of neighborhoods. They're shrinking. You're just seeing things being boarded up or torn down, nothing going up. And most of the guys and I, we sit around and we're looking like, okay, the city need housing, we need jobs. Why can't the city put us to work to build housing so everybody wins? You just keep boarding them up and tearing them down. You're going to work, and right now minimum wage is, what, $7.25? I think the fair market rent is, what, something like $12.50 a month. There's no way in the world you can afford that. You would have to work 3.4 part-time jobs or something like 134, 38 hours a week just to meet market rate apartments.
So, Kate, then how do you define for the mayor's office even what homelessness means?
Well, we often use – actually, we really go back to the HUD definition of homelessness when we do it, because HUD funds the majority – I'm sorry, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development funds the majority of our budget. And so we really use their definition of what homelessness is when we are applying it to the programs that we fund, because that – makes the most sense for us. And so HUD recently changed its definition of homelessness, actually, to try to really correct some of the problems that were created in 1987 when McKinney-Vento was rolled out. And so it used to be actually a 4-sentence definition of homelessness, and now it's about 40 pages.
It's a 4-part definition.
Yeah, it is a 4-part definition. So part one is literally homeless, people who are living in places not meant for human habitation. Part two is people who are in emergency shelter or in transitional housing. Part three, I believe, is those who are imminently homeless. So that's what facing eviction or we're going to be homeless within 14 days. And then part four gets tricky, and it's those people who meet the federal definition of homelessness under McKinney-Vento statutes in other areas if they meet X, Y, and Z also.
So and then I'm going to go back to Ed, but but let me first ask you this question, Adrian. I mean, so here you've come in to take this Journey Home job, and which is when it first began was to end homelessness in 10 years in Baltimore. I don't think we're on target for that, or even close. Maybe you can correct that, but I don't see that. I'm not even sure what that means. And that do we compartmentalize this issue of homelessness so much that we can't wrap our hands around it if this is the only way we define it?
So one thing I'll say is, yes, the Journey Home was initially adopted in 2008 as a 10-year plan. But one thing I think is important to note is that we are committed to seeing this plan through, whether it takes 10 years or whether it takes 100 years. And that's one thing that's, I think, not unique to Baltimore, but it's unique to communities across the country.
Right. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Oh, no, it's something that's unique to, or not unique to Baltimore, but unique to, is something that we're seeing in communities across the country. We have these 10-year plans. We're not on target to end homelessness or within 10 years. But the thing is that we need to remain committed to the goal. We need to remain committed to the vision that we're going to make homelessness rare and brief. And the Journey Home really sets out that roadmap for how we're going to get there. It has 4 goals that collectively will work together to make homelessness rare and brief. One of them is to increase the supply of affordable housing, which we've been touching on in our conversation already today. We also need to increase access to health care for people with low incomes. But as Tony alluded to, you know, incomes and employment opportunities is another big key factor that's going to help us to end homelessness. A lot of, you know, the people experiencing homelessness in Baltimore, it's a pretty skilled workforce. and there aren't the jobs out there for them, or they're not making enough so that they can afford housing.
So I want to go to the phones here, but let me just take very quickly. I want to ask Tony a question before I go back to Ed. Go ahead.
Okay, so you had mentioned a good point earlier about limiting ourselves to that particular definition of homelessness. We're just one part of the solution to this. The journey home is very expansive, and it really calls for everyone to be involved, businesses, community, other agencies besides the Mayor's Office of Human Services. And so, you know, as the funds were diminishing on the federal level, the program populations were being restricted. So most of the funding that we receive can go towards housing folks who are disabled, permanently disabled. And HUD every year has limited the number of new dollars that have come out that restrict it just to those persons who are experiencing chronic homelessness. So it keeps, you know, our office gets more constrained every year.
So if the definitions, one of the things, if the definitions are by the, set by the federal government and HUD, constrain the ability of your work to get things done the way you want to, the question then is, does the city have an alternative that we could do that's something different? One of the things you were quoted in the article is saying, Tony, when Ed wrote the article, Ed wrote this piece, he said, Tony said he will not go into his own home until all the people are housed.
Yeah. I was a Marine for 8 years, and we have a
Marine.
Saying. Yeah. We have a saying, no soldiers left behind, and that's pretty much what I mean. When I'm on that lot and I'm out there on the street and I'm advocating and I'm seeing so many people out there, and I'm just saying to myself, how can I leave them? If everybody's just up and leave, who's going to help lead the journey home? I agree with what Ms. Kate Bedell and Ms. Adrian that it is going to take everybody to, you know, pitch in and help, you know, this plan to work. But for me, as an advocate, I just don't see myself right now just backing out. I've come too far, and I always say this path was chosen for me. I didn't choose it.
So I have a question for here before I go back to Adam. Ed, we have 2 minutes to break, and then we're going to go right to the phones and go to Shotgun, who called in at 410-319-8888. You can join that person to join in. My assumption is a man. I have to say him, but who knows? 410-319-8888. Ed, take us to break with your thought of what you've heard so far about this commentary on the piece you wrote.
The whole program, the Journey Home, one of the points of that is that there's going to be, you know, employment for people. And this is supposedly done on the local level. And I just don't see how the city of Baltimore can be made responsible for changing the wage scale and the job opportunities for thousands of people. I don't think any city in the country has been able to do that, and I really don't think any politicians in local, you know, situations are really capable of doing that either. It's a policy problem in that the Journey Home model pushes the responsibility down to the local level. Instead of where it used to reside, which is at the federal level, where, you know, you could work in big, you know, in big ways. So that's, you know, that's one major thing I think is the problem. The other thing is that somebody mentioned that the way housing works changed since the 80s, and the public the private market in housing, you used to be able to get a rent for a reasonable amount of money, but then housing became, you know, everybody's get rich quick scheme. And that's what we're seeing right now. So there's somebody on North Fulton right now who's got a house he bought for $2,000 out of the tax sale. He's going from one family to two family. It's in the city council. It's a wreck right now. I think he might have put a new roof on it, or maybe. But, you know, if he can get that house together for $40,000 or $45,000 all in, and then put essentially two families, which could mean 16 people unrelated, right, something like that, you know, his rent roll is going to be, you know, what's 16 times 300, something like that. That's the reason there's no low affordable housing for low-income people. One of the people I met in line was paying $725 for a place on North Avenue that didn't have hot water.
Can I chime in here for a second?
You can. Then we have to go to break. You have 30 seconds
Great.
To chime in.
No, absolutely. You know, I think Edward did a really good job of summarizing the importance of how we need all levels of government to be involved in the solution. You know, we're going to push to the fullest extent of our authority at the local level to see the journey home through. But, you know, it has implications for what's happening in Washington, D.C. And that's really why we need not only the city to be working towards this, but we need our friends at the state and federal level to be doing it as well.
So, folks, join us here, 410-319-8888. We have Shotgun on the line, and we've got Joe just wrote in. We'll read those two things. They're actually related. 410-319-8888. We'll be right back. Stay with us as we the next half hour. We're going to rest with what problems can the city answer? We'll be right back. Because there's a book that. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. On the way out of our last break, we went out with Idris Muhammad, a great piece that he did. Of course, Power of Soul, born on this day in 1939. We are here talking about homelessness in our city because of the Gimme Shelter article in the city paper written by Ed Erickson. We are joined by Adrian Bridenstine. I say that right, right?
Yes.
Bridenstine, Executive Director of Journey Home at the Mayor's Office of Human Services. Kate Bedell, who is Bridell. Who is Director of Homeless Services at the Mayor's Office of Human Services. Tony Simmons, Housing Advocate, member of Housing Our Neighbors, and Adam Schneider, Director of Community Relations for Healthcare for the Homeless. And we're going to – I promise, Shotgun, we're coming to your call, but I want to go to Adam just to begin the conversation about what can a city do?
Well, I mean, I think it's really important to understand that this is multi-level, right? I mean
– right.
Recently in the Times, Mark Rank wrote a piece about poverty and that poverty has become mainstream in the country and that 40% of people between 25 and 60 will live in poverty at least for a year of their life. Over 50% will live at 150% of poverty. And we have to recognize that the federal poverty level is extremely low. So what we're talking about is seeing a widening gap between the well-to-do and the people who are really struggling. And that is going to take federal policy. But we can on the state level and at the local level look at ways to increase minimum wages. I mean, that's something that the state is considering now, that the city has considered increasing the minimum wage. But most of the time when we're talking about increasing the minimum wage, and Tony touched on this, the fact that right now the minimum wage in the state of Maryland is $7.25 an hour. In order to be able to afford an efficiency unit, just an efficiency unit in the city of Baltimore, a full-time worker would have to earn $16.27 an hour without working over 40 hours a week. So we're talking about over double the minimum wage, would have to work almost 100 hours a week at minimum wage to be able to afford an efficiency unit. And that's something that we could do something about. We could create a more robust inclusionary zoning. Other cities around the country have created housing using the inclusionary zoning model. We've created a handful of units, and they tend to be affordable to social workers and not people who are served by social workers. We also – I mean the 10-year plan does have things that the city can be doing, and we need to really focus energy on that. And we also need to not be reactive. We see people who are on the streets, and right now one of the things that is bubbling up as it does periodically is the idea of criminalizing poverty. That really is an ineffective response. It's understandable that people not knowing what to do and feeling uncomfortable by public begging want to respond, but we should feel uncomfortable.
So let me open the phones right away here at 410-319-8888. A number of people are calling in, and Shotgun, you're on the air.
Hey, family, I just want to let everybody know that I appreciate the panel you have today, and thank you, Mark Steiner, for bringing this plight to the forefront. I thank everybody. Hey, Tony, hey, Adam. You know, we are there in the trenches, and we see it every day. I had the opportunity to go to social services yesterday, and I saw over 2,000 people online trying to get benefits, which they didn't even have. Most of them were homeless and on the street and don't have an opportunity to say, you know, I mean, thank you for the food, but however, the food stamps that they get, they're non-cooked food, so therefore they have to have a place to cook them in. There's another effort that, I mean, I heard the panel talk about the city is trying to help out, but yet they have something on the pages coming up about no panhandling and, or vicious, malicious panhandling downtown in any place that serves food or ATMs or anything to that effect. And when you're letting people out of a shelter in the middle of the morning and can't go back for another 12 to 14 hours, that comes into laundering and panhandling and everything else, because they got to do something while they're on the streets, because we don't have outside shelters that open up to the public anymore. To be cold blue is no longer cold blue. I thank everybody for participating and helping out with Word on the Street newspaper, so we can give resources to such people. But we also need help to spread the word that there are some resources out there. And I know it's a time-consuming thing. It doesn't happen overnight.
Right.
However, we can be the prototype for it, because, like you said, we're the richest state in the richest America. And as a veteran, we just served Veterans Day. And here we are fighting overseas and fighting everywhere about democracy, and we don't feel it right here. And the most hurt people are some of our veterans that are out there that are on the street. We had over 100 people die last year on the streets right here in Baltimore City, and 26 of them were veterans.
Shotgun, I appreciate the call, and we also wrote, Joe wrote in to say, just heard a new version of the panhandling bill will be introduced on Monday, and to follow up what Shotgun was saying, is this panhandling bill, I mean, it seems to fly in the face of everything that we're trying to do here at Journey Home, or people or working advocating for people who are homeless. I mean, it will, in fact, mean that more people will be arrested for asking for money on the street, right?
You're absolutely right. It was a bad bill, and I was happy to be tossed from City Hall. It wasn't a bill about the city of Baltimore. It was a bill about staying away from downtown, you know, staying away from the tourist industry. I mean, you can panhandle in any poor neighborhood in Baltimore, and no one would bat an eye. The bill was just targeting, you know, the inner harbors, the hotels, and the street corners. But you understand, people who are out there panhandling, you know, some people always say, well, drug addicts and alcoholics. But there are people who are hungry. Like, if you go to Daily Bread any day, you have families who are housed but can't afford to put food on their table. So they have no choices but to go to soup kitchens. So this bill was just targeting the homeless population. It wasn't targeting any other sector of the population in Baltimore.
So I want to chime in here, and just to provide some national perspective, I was at the federal level before I came here. You know, one thing when we see these criminalization type policies, and they're not effective policies, they're reactive policies. You know, Denver passed a camping ban last year. So, you know, Baltimore is moving in the same direction, but it's a reactive policy, and it's not a solution. What we really need to focus on is housing. And I think our caller alluded to the fact about our hemorrhaging safety net. And Kate talked earlier about how, you know, continually our continuum of care and our homeless services are being asked to do more with less money and less resources. And it's something that at the city we grapple with every day. We know that we don't have the shelter is not at the capacity it needs to be to serve everyone in the community. But do we invest in shelter, building more shelter? Well, no, shelter's not the solution. That's not going to end homelessness. We can't shelter our way out of homelessness. Or do we invest in evidence-based practices like the housing first approach or just housing opportunities in general for people experiencing homelessness? And this is a struggle, and this is something that at the city we grapple with. I know it's something that Adam grappled with at Healthcare for the Homeless. The community struggles with where do we invest our very limited resources? And one opportunity, you know, you asked what can the city do? We can continue to broker our public-private partnerships because that's how we're going to get this done. It can't just be on the city's plate to really end homelessness. We need this, everyone at the table, as Kate said earlier, and public-private partnerships is one opportunity we can continue to pursue to help to create more housing opportunities and get the job done.
410-309-8888 is the number here. And we're going to go to our next caller in just a second. Ed, let me ask you to set something up, though. One of the things you wrote in this piece was you thought that part of the problem was the fragmentation of the approach and services. You wrote that in the piece.
Yeah. Yeah, everything's been sort of privatized in government since I've been, you know, an adult. And it's always to save money, right? Because city employees, they get a pension. At least right now they still do. They won't for long. So what you do, if you're somebody like Kate or Adrian, and they didn't make these policies, they just have to live with their budgets, is you say, well, okay, we'll put this job off on, you know, Catholic Charities or some other place like that, and let them worry about, well, you know, paying people. So that's what's happening, and two bad things happen because of that. I don't think it's the fault of anybody in your room right there. But one bad thing that happens about that is you get a harder management job for the people at the top because that they now have to coordinate a whole bunch of people who they don't have full control over, right? And that's what's happening. The other thing that happens, which I think is bad also, is you the people who you hire then subcontract other stuff. And that's how you get people in the parking lot in a false way there who are like the guard or something like that, and they're telling people, oh, well, if you come back here after you leave, you know, we're going to have you arrested. And they're doing that because they're trying to do their job, all right? But it scares the bejesus out of people. And that's why Ada Hicks, who I talked to that night and who was sort of stuck, she thought she couldn't walk back on the property, right? Well, that's because she got misinformation, but that's because, you know, everything is, you know, sort of stratified and scattered. And then it changes every year or every 2 years or something like that when the contract is up. So you can't coordinate as well because of the system we have.
So, Kate, you were shaking your head no during the whole time that Ed was talking. Why?
Well, part of it was because we're bureaucrats at the city level. Our job is to fund community-based organizations who are best trained to meet the needs and work with the clients that they're encountering. That's what we do. You know, the money comes in and someone has to make sure that it goes out to agencies that are capable of working with clients and really trying to help them achieve permanency and self-sufficiency. It goes back to what I had said earlier about the system popping up as projects and not systems. And so what we're really working towards now is taking a systemic view of things. And so one of the things we're working on is coordinated intake. And this is a process that is required by HUD as one of the things that we need to be doing, but it's also really good practice. And so we are trying to work with our community partners. Adam's been on the group. I don't know, Tony, have you been on that group? No. Have been working on this group to design what will help get people into the system and triaged, if you will, into the best placement for them until a permanent housing solution can be found for them. And so we've been working for the last 6 months or so to get that in place. And it, like I said, it's a community group that's working on this. And so we're just really trying to hit it from every angle so that when somebody is experiencing homelessness, they pick up the phone or they walk into one of the walk-in centers and they do an intake with one of the workers who says to them, okay, based on what we know about you, this is the really best place for you to be safe tonight. And then we'll make a referral for you to get into this other program.
So, but it seems to me, and then we'll go to the next caller, Bruce, we're going to get you a call, and whoever else calls in on 410-319-8888 and writes to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. But it seems something's missing here. And I want to figure out what's missing in this conversation.
I think that moving from a project-centric view to a systemic-centric view is really important. I mean, coordinated intake, trying to figure out the best way to use our resources. We also need to look at the broader system that is creating this problem. As we talked about before, McKinney-Vento was intended to be an emergency solution. What we need to talk about, what we need to dedicate resources to, and is changing fundamentally the causes of homelessness. If we simply focus on homelessness, we're never going to solve it. And that's, I think, one of the real strengths of the 10-year plan is it does have this analysis that the problem is that there's not enough housing that people can afford, that people's incomes are too low. And we've only talked about people who are earning wages that are inadequate or people who are unemployed. People who have disabilities, serious disabilities, the federal government provides SSI to people who have serious disabilities. That benefit is slightly more than $700 a month. And $700 a month, you're not going to be able to find housing. And those folks are the lucky folks because while people are applying for federal disability benefits, the state of Maryland provides a temporary disability assistance that's $185 a month. It's no wonder that people with disabilities are begging for change when the state of Maryland provides only $185 to live.
And it's a loan.
It's a loan. That's important, yes.
What do you mean? And it's a loan?
It's a loan, yes. So when people are approved for federal benefits, they have to pay the state back the amount of money that the state has provided to them in that $185 benefit before they get their back payment.
So the other side of this table, and the other side of this equation, and Tony, I just want to – as somebody who is – been homeless, who fights in the street about homelessness every day. And so the question is, what push has to happen to wake the community and the city council up? I mean, whether it's the idea of pushing the idea that inclusionary housing has to just be – has to have a law – has to be the law with teeth in it, or what we do with abandoned housing in the city and how the city should respond to it, or the panhandling law, or any number of things I could think of. There are a wide range of groups, whether it's United Workers, Your Word on the Street, the organization you're working with, Adam, Healthcare for the Homeless, that are pushing the issue in very kind of deep and, I'll use the word, radical ways to kind of say something has to change. But that's a voice that seems to be missing in this.
Yeah. I was just talking with my group, Housing Our Neighbors, the other day. I'm homeless for 2 years. And I've been on the street for 2 years, and I've been advocating for 2 years. And what I found is the biggest problem is because everybody is operating separately. No one has ever decided, you know what, let's have one big roundtable discussion. Bring in everybody. Bring in the politicians, the housing developers. Bring in the community. Bring in the churches. Bring in us, the homeless, who knows best what we need. The worst thing about the house is to tell the homeless what we need. I mean, there has never been a meeting that I know of that the homeless was included within a meeting. The same thing would happen with Ms. Hicks. Lack of communication. They don't communicate very well, and it ends up everybody operating separately, and it takes work. You got to kind of like, you know, bend over backwards to find out where you can get housing and where can you get health care, where can you get this. Because there's no one in nowhere that we've ever been included in to say, you know what, we're going to roll up our sleeves and let's get it done. We've been talking about this 10-year plan for 5 years, and we're still sitting here talking about a 10-year plan. Let's roll up our sleeves, take a deep breath, and let's get it done. I've been on the street for 2 years. There's been 105 people who lost their lives in 2012. We have not done the numbers this year. You know, one is too many, in my opinion.
And we had to be very fair. 105 people, not all of them died literally on the streets, but people died because of homelessness.
Because of homelessness.
As a result of homelessness. Yeah. And I tell you, in all the years I've worked in the very beginning with the Journey Home and I was on the meetings, the people who actually were homeless were never in these meetings.
So I just want to chime in. Tony, I think you're right. The key to seeing this plan through really is broad community involvement, as we've been talking about from all levels of government, but also from the private sector and the nonprofit sector. And one of the things that we're doing to bring people to the table is we're restructuring. As Mark said, he was on the leadership advisory group, and we're restructuring that group to create a Journey Home board. And this Journey Home board will include people who were homeless or formerly homeless among a an array of other stakeholders, like our philanthropic partners, the business community, public housing, housing developers, social services, just to name a few. And we recognize that things need to start to happen in a more coordinated and mobilized way. We need to mobilize our resources and our people towards making homelessness rare and brief. And one way to do it is to restructure and make sure that we have everyone at the table that needs to be there so voices are heard and that the planning and implementation can really happen.
Let me go to the phones, get a quick call in here. So I want to come back with something that was in this article about I'm connecting the idea of the abandoned houses in the city and the ability to rehab them. But Bruce, you're on the air. Your thoughts?
Yeah. Good morning. First off, the gentleman about the bill for against panhandling is a stupid bill, and the guy nailed it. It's about the people, the downtown, protecting the downtown tourist area for the businessmen. But also on minimum wage, I agree the minimum wage should be waived, but you got to be practical and pragmatic about it. So they're talking that raising, he mentioned, in order to get decent housing, $16.25 an hour. Then it becomes an inflationary spiral. So, fine, raise the minimum wage, but do it little steps at a time. Maybe from $7.25 to $8.25 one year, then $9 the next year. But once you raise it that quickly, then there'll be a situation where all the retail, all business people want to raise the prices on their products and services, and it becomes an inflationary spiral.
Adam?
Well, and how we get there, I think, is a question. The fact that in order to be able to afford an efficiency unit in Baltimore City at fair market rent, you have to earn $16.27 an hour. In order to be able to afford a two-bedroom unit, you have to earn about $23 an hour. So it's
let me pop in here, okay? The mean wage for people that even mean wage, you know, the average, more people more people make that. In the United States right now, it's $13.22. Half of everybody makes less than that. That's $3 less than you need just to have an efficiency here. That's the problem.
And if you look at – and another piece that came out in our show the other day was that as we looked at the analysis of what people are paid in America and the average wage, that if you kept up with productivity of the economy – not just what the minimum wage would be in this economy, but the productivity of the American economy, then the minimum wage should be $17.65. If you dealt with the productivity of the American economy. That's the disconnect.
Minimum wage should be in the mid-20s.
So,
exactly.
Even thinking back 50 years to the March for Jobs and Justice, I mean, the demand there was $2 an hour minimum wage. If you adjusted that for inflation, it would be over $15 an hour. So, I mean, what we're talking about isn't something that's especially radical. What it is something that responds to what the needs are.
One of the things I said that was said in here was that when we were saying that they lost in the article construction jobs, they asked why the city doesn't put them to work. Because many of the homeless were construction workers building homes for themselves instead of spending millions of dollars demolishing vacant homes. And you were, I think, were quoted as saying, the idea of having them build their own homes would be a complicated policy question to figure out. I think that was the quote.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
So, but let's talk about, because we've had that issue come up on this program before. We've talked about that. But your thought first, and then we'll go over here.
I do believe it's a complicated policy question, but it's not one that if we had the right partners at the table, that wouldn't be worth exploring for sure.
So there's more to the quote than just the quote.
Yeah.
So, but what about things? One of the things people have said over and over again, we have lots of people in this, and we had people who called in when they were saying, you know, when we're going to rebuild our schools, what about all the unemployed construction workers with deep skills in Baltimore City who don't have jobs? We can rebuild these homes. But where would the money come from to do that? How would we do that?
Well, it's about priorities, right? I mean, we find money when we have it as a priority. I mean, that's you don't have to look that far back into the pages of the Baltimore Sun to see times that we've invested money when it's a priority. And this isn't just – again, it's not just a city issue. This is a state issue. This is a federal issue. And to see Baltimore as simply the end-all, be-all – is, I think, a mistake, because this is within a much broader structure. So we need to be looking much more broadly than the city. The city isn't going to be able to by itself address the fact that over the past 30 years we have reduced substantially to about 40% of what it was back in the late 70s HUD's budget. We're not going to be able to do that. What we need to do is think creatively about what we do from here, because we know that we can end homelessness. I mean, we end homelessness for individuals all the time. What we need to look is what are the individual solutions and how do we translate that broader. We also have ended homelessness before as a nation. In 1929, we had a great recession, a great depression.
Depression.
In fact, and today it's not as bad as it was then. We could look at the policies that were implemented back then. We had much more engaged government and others to solve this problem. That's what we need.
Let's take a quick call in here before we end the show. Meredith in Baltimore, you're on the air. Very quick thought, Meredith.
Good morning. What I'm concerned about in terms of the panhandling law is children panhandling, and I've seen children on the street panhandling, particularly young cheerleaders in short skirts, and I'm so deathly afraid that these girls might get snatched up or molested while they're out there, and there are no adults in sight. So how do we craft a bill that protects these children and bans these children from panhandling while allowing other people to do what they need to do?
That's a good question. I think we can't wrestle with that one today, but I think that...
Well, I'd like to answer you. Do you know there's a lot of children out here are homeless, and that's their means of supporting themselves? You have a high population of homeless kids out here, and we need to go out here and save our children. And, Mark, you said where we can start? Well, let's start by not giving billionaires another $107 million and use that kind of money to fund job training or building more communities. You know, but I understand there are children out there and you want to protect them, but you got to realize we need more services for the children who are homeless and living out there on the street.
It's a show we'll be doing soon about homeless kids in our community who are living in places. We'll be talking about that very soon. And I think what our caller was talking about was the kids who are from their churches and rec programs raising money in the corner. She was worried about their safety. That's something that she was talking about. But I want to thank you all for being here. This has been a really interesting conversation. First of all, Ed Erickson, thank you for the piece you wrote.
Thanks.
Very important piece, I think. Thought-provoking and pushing the issue. Tony Simmons, good to have you in the studio.
Always a pleasure, Mark.
Member of Housing Our Neighbors, 2 years homeless. Adam Schneider, Director of Community Relations for Healthcare for the Homeless. Kate Burdell, Director of Homeless Services Program at the Mayor's Office of Human Services. And Adrian Bridenstine, who is the Executive Director of Journey Home, also at the Mayor's Office of Human Services. Services. Good to have you all in the studio.
Thank you for having
me. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Mark.
And we are going to take a brief break. When we come back, we'll be looking at another issue of wages, poverty, and more. Are the new poor in our community adjunct professors who teach in our universities and colleges? Stay with us.